Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
We had Chris de Burgh in recently enough there to talk about the big lessons he learned in his life, and I think you really enjoyed it. So we're going to do it again, this time with Mary Coughlan. Welcome, Mary.
Good morning.
I feel you'll have a slightly different perspective on things to Chris.
I like Chris P. Chris.
No, we love Chris, but you've led a different life. So come here, you did a big gig at the Galway Arts Festival last week. How was that?
Mental.
Yeah.
It was a great crack. It was really, really great. Didn't think I'd be able to, you know, like fill the big red tent, whatever you call it, the big top, but it was brilliant. And it was really nice because mostly people from Chantilly came.
Yeah.
I mean, there was whole sections of them over there from Chantilly and people from Galway and people I went to school with, and it was really nice. So, and half my family came.
Yeah. And you're revisiting your first album, Tired and Emotional, now 40 years later. 40 years since that. Does it bring up ghosts?
Obviously. But when I started out, you know, when I started working with Eric was in 1983, and we started working on little songs, and we entered a talent competition, and we didn't win, and you know, we were really pissed off, and so he went away on tour, he got very famous, and he came back. He said we really should do something. He said we'll do some songs and we'll, you know, hawk them around to some people. And at the same time, Siobhan McHugh and Shay Hennessy, Shay. You know, he did. Sounds promising.
We'll find out.
God, his name has just gone out of my mind. And he had a thing on the radio called Sounds Promising, and you brought up your cassette, or you sent in your cassette. And if you...
Shay Healy.
Shay Healy and Siobhan McHugh, and I sent them the cassette, and there was three songs on it, and they, if you won, they brought you to Dublin to record in Studio 8. And we came up, we won. And that was kind of the start of it. And we met Gay Byrne there, and he said, who are you? And blah, blah, blah. And will you be on the Late Late Show? Would you like to be on the Late Late Show? So we were actually on the Late Late Show before we got to Sounds Promising, as it turned out.
Right.
And that was just over 40 years ago.
You were shy back then, were you?
Yeah.
Do you grow out of shyness?
Well, I think that I drank a lot because I was shy, you know.
Yeah.
I was talking to your researcher the other day, and we were talking about the song The Double Cross, which was the first number one hit song, or whatever you call it,
yeah,
of that first album. My ex-husband wrote it. And I suppose I was only 19 when I got married in Haditha, you know. And he saw things in me that he wrote about in that song that I ignored, you know, like I lift up my pants, hitch up your pants and fake it like a man. I had a job as a street sweeper in London, and with your glass in hand, you have a word for one and all, you know, like he knew me very well, you know, but I never gave him his, I used to just really take the piss out of the song, you know, say, I'm not going to sing this song because every time I sing it, he'd get paid. But nowadays, I see the song for what everybody else saw in it, you know.
Yeah, so you didn't know yourself then?
I didn't know myself.
Yeah. Come here, I believe you're confronting your mortality. You're making a will. There must be some lessons in that, is there?
Stop. Well, I don't know. I just never... I had this superstitious thing about making a will.
Yeah.
Like that if I make a will, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
But I think that's a real old-fashioned way of looking at it, is it?
I don't know. I'd be with you on that.
Have you made yours?
No.
Oh, Jesus. Well, anyways, I went down and I have a lovely solicitor in Bray. His name is John McGuire. And he said, you know, you should really think about every will day. There's a will day every year. Did you know that? Make a will day.
No, I'm blocking it out.
Oh, yeah.
I'm never going
anyways,
to die.
I went and got all my bits and pieces together. But that was the part that was freaky. I mean, going through boxes of stuff and looking for bits of paper and deeds for houses and bits of divorces and bits of, you know, all that stuff. Separation.
You had to do a stock take literally of life so far, yeah?
Yeah, and it was, I mean, and then I would get stuck there in the box of stuff.
Yeah.
And the whole day would be gone and I'd be either bawling, crying or throwing things out the window or tearing things up or whatever because so much stuff. As you can imagine, in over more than 40 years of just being in this business has happened. So when I laid it all out, finally in front of Joe, we talked about it and he said, well, you know, I always had thought about, look all I've lost. Like when I came to Dublin first, I was signed to Warner Brothers. I had a house up next door to Kebburn, 2.5 acres up on the Bailey, you know. I lost all of that. And he said, but look now, all that you have, you know, you have all of your children living with you again. They're literally living in the house with me, some of them back again. You have the grandchildren, you have this beautiful place, which you told me you really wanted to buy 25 years ago because you wanted it to be sanctuary. And he reminded me of the time that I went looking for the house up on the Little Sugarloaf. And the house got bigger and bigger, like little add-ons and stuff. And now my son, Owen, who's, I can't remember what age he is, he's about 42 or 43, he's in there. And Claire and Kieran were there with the three kids for a while. And they built their own house. They moved out a month ago. And now there's another one come back.
So lesson one, don't think about everything you've lost. Think about everything you have.
Everything that you have.
Brilliant.
Look at all of you have now, Mary. Plus the peace and the work. Look at all I have now. Yeah.
What advice would you give her on money?
Spend it.
Yeah. Okay.
Not foolishly. Not foolishly, whatever. But like, I had a lot of it and I drank and put it up my nose. You know, really, that's what we did with money years ago. I have money now and I took the kids, the two little boys. We went skiing up in Lapland. Up in a place called Rovaniemi, way up, not Santaland, now not in a kind of a, because I've been, I did a lot of work in Finland, so I know places to go.
Do you ski, yeah?
Oh yes, like I put my arse into a black plastic bag and I ski that way. But the kids are really, really good at skiing. I just went on the small things for kids, you know, I can't ski. But they skied. And
this is a very bourgeois pastime for Mary Cockney.
Sliding around mountains in a black plastic bag. So we had a great time there. But it's not on a ski. It's not on a proper ski place. People up there ski downtown.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know,
they ski.
They go around skiing. Like, they have no other way of getting around the town.
Yeah.
So we go to
Money, not an end in itself. It's a thing to use
to get
where you need to go.
Yeah,
okay.
And we did stuff like that and do things with the kids mostly with the money and, you know.
Yeah.
There's no point in keeping it.
Yeah, okay.
Enough of it to keep in here, but...
So you're saying about the house now up in Wicklow, isn't
yeah.
it? You have found peace there.
Yeah, it's just so, this looks like one of your pictures over there behind you. It's on the side of the Sugarloaf. It's a dirt road. It's hard to get to. It's not a place where I thought I'd end up.
Yeah.
But it's definitely where I wanted to be. And it seems where the rest of them want to be now too.
So peace then, you kind of have to be ready for it, You have to go through everything else to get to the peace, yeah.
When I decided I wanted to live there, I mean, did I really? Did I really want to live down in Bray in a flat? Did I really want to sell the house to Frank and on the seafront? Where did I want to live? And I spent with John, my partner, I spent a lot of time walking around up there and looking at this particular house, you know. And I was getting into the shamanic training thing that I was doing for a while. And your man said... He said, I'll give you a task, he said, and you know, you have to go home now, he said, and get a small, like a paint can or something, a tin, you know, it doesn't have to be very elaborate, he said, but it has to, or an old bucket. And you're going to have to stay there alone all night long. And with your thoughts and your little bits of paper and your stones and your this, that, and the other, and light a fire and put your back to the house that you want to live in and stay with the fire for the entire night and see if that's where you want to be when you wake up in the morning, or, well, you didn't go to sleep. So I've kind of made my peace with a lot of things that night.
Really, would you recommend it, yeah?
Well, I was scared that my animals might come out and eat me, or a big wolf would come and eat me or something. But no, my whole life kind of flashed, and I asked, look, you just have to know what I was talking about. We'd be here forever.
Oh, no, I like it, though, yeah. Could people do this themselves? Like, you have to be on your own, do you?
Oh, you'd have to be on your own,
and sit out for a whole night,
fire
lit.
Yeah.
And then let it all come up. Yeah. Let it flow, baby. Yeah.
Let it all come up for healing.
And lighter the next morning, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a cave. So it's where I go when I want to be quiet. I'm an old woman now. I'm a crone. So that's what I'm called, technically.
Is this?
An old witch.
It's a technical term, right? Sure, what do you wish you'd known starting out in your career?
What do I wish I'd known?
Hmm.
Jesus. That it was going to be so crazy and weird. I hadn't a clue. I mean, I thought when I got to the Bagot Inn that this was, unbelievable, you know?
Yeah.
When I got to play with the Olympia, I thought, oh my God, this is, my parents are there, my grandmother, when my granny came up to the Late Late Show. You know, I thought that was it. You know, I thought that was it. I thought that's what fame, you know, would be for me. But it got really crazy after a while. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, go on.
I saw cocaine when I was about 30. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
I didn't know what it was for. I didn't know how you used it. I quickly got to become very fond of it, and I knew lots of different ways to use it. But then I went absolutely insane, and I think everybody knows that, for several years. But what I also wasn't prepared for was the amount of control. And Eric said it to me at one point. He said, they keep you like this so that you don't know what's going on, you know. He was talking about record company executives. And he said, the longer you stay out of it and they're completely in control of what you wear, what you sing, the producers that you use, you know, you can't do that song, you know. And I started slipping into that whole area, you know. They were telling me I couldn't sing that song. And I remember going over to London with Dennis Desmond at once and going into Warner Brothers, and he said, just leave, let me handle it now, you know, let me handle it, you know. And no, I said, I want to come in. So I went to come in, and they said, you cannot sing that song, and you cannot sing that song. But if you sing that song, we might let you sing that song. And Dennis brought me outside. He said, sit there now, Mary. He said, and get a cup of coffee for yourself or go shopping, and we'll come to a compromise. So I definitely didn't want to lose what I had.
Yeah.
I wanted the life. I had a couple of albums at that stage. I had a house. I had a name around Ireland and a lot of other countries. So the compromise was that I wouldn't sing. They wouldn't let me sing The Little Death, and they wouldn't let me sing The Whiskey Didn't Kill the Pain unless I sang Invisible and Man of the World. So I said, no problem.
And now, so you're not doing down Dennis with that story at all. He was very good to you, hasn't he?
Dennis Desmond was the only person who ever came and rescued me at 3 o'clock in the morning when the pink elephant would come and say, she's here again, you'll have to come and get her. But what I understood was that if you would get what you want if you gave them a little bit as well.
Yeah.
But then they dropped me anyway, you know. I was too hard to handle, you know.
Okay. So a little bit of compromise to get what you want. Okay. Outwardly, you appear very strong now. How are you now with being vulnerable? What have you learned about that?
I suppose the songs that I have always chosen were sad songs, really, when I look back on them, always. But I would like put my hands in my pockets and look at
lean in there, yeah.
Look, you know, I'd kind of, you know, be putting my hands in my pockets and looking down at the ground, and I never looked at people, you know. And since I and I drank to put those feelings, you know, to kind of soften them out a bit. And when I stopped drinking, and the feelings that the songs and the words brought up, I just got to, I'm going to do this, you know, I'm able to do this now, you know. And then I noticed that other people wanted to hear them too, and wanted to feel, you know. I've often, in small concerts, I go down and ask somebody if they were all right, because they would be feeling something in particular from, you know, Love Will Tear Us Apart or something.
And yeah,
a lot of people.
So you have to go there for them to get them there.
Yeah, but I love to go there now.
Yeah.
Every time I go there, it heals me.
Okay.
I mean, really heals me. I mean, I root myself to the ground, and the guys in the band would know that, you know, how it works, you know. It just, the energy goes up and up and up and up and up until it explodes, you know, and then it goes out into the...
And then, you see, in a way, it's a safe space to do that in a stage.
Yeah.
And then you've been very honest always, and often vulnerable in life as well, and in talking like you are here and everything. Do you regret any of that now?
If I had done it in a sensible way, if I had done it from a place of compassion and where I am now, you know, I mean, I'm talking about other people today and stuff, rather than from a place of anger where I was at the time, there was a huge amount of anger between both of us, you know.
You and Sinead, yeah.
Myself and Sinead. Yeah, well, that's what I was talking about there, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm sure.
And I am... In quieter moments, on her anniversary the other day, I would, you know, be lighting a candle to her and talking to her, and just wishing that it hadn't been that way, you know. But we were both very, very hurt at the time, and it came out like that, you know. But that was a long time ago now. That's 20 years ago. And I've learned a lot in 20 years.
Does the recovery... Does it kind of make a person very honest? Because I think the 12 steps, as I understand it, there's no hiding place there, is there, like?
There's 12 steps. The 12 steps are sort of a beginning place, really, I think, you know. I know the 12 steps. I don't do AA. I did it. I was asked to do it for 2 years, and I did. After that, I became aware that it kind of, you hand your responsibility over to a group of people or a kind of, it's not a religion, it's, you know.
Yeah, okay.
You know.
So say in the initial recovery then, you went to the Rutland Centre.
I went there twice a week. I went to a one-to-one counselling with Mara Russell and an evening with my group, you know.
And I presume there's no room for bull there.
Oh, Jesus.
And then, you get confronted as well. Is some of that stuff you're confronted with, like, by your kids or whatever, is that honesty hard to hear, yeah?
Yeah, my kids came into the Rutland Centre and told me stuff, what it was like to live with me, and, you know, when I was drinking, how scared they were of me. And one of my kids particularly scared to be in the car with me because he knew I was drunk. And another daughter told everybody that I slapped her across the face because she was pouring my vodka down the sink. And I was angry, you know, that these things were being taken away from me. I knew they were going to be taken away from me. I knew I was going to lose all these crutches, you know. And it took 5 or 6 years. Like, I would moan to my counsellor in the Rutland Centre, they're still smelling my breath and searching my bag 2 years later. And she says, well, you know, suck it up, you know. They would sniff my breath coming out of the bathroom and search my handbag and stuff, you know.
And did your kids forgive you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think they'd be back living with me if they hadn't.
And did you forgive yourself?
That's longer. That took an awful lot longer, yeah.
And have you now?
For most of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Every day it gets a little easier.
Okay. Any secret hack there for forgiving yourself? Because I think lots of people would like to forgive themselves in lots of different ways.
What happened to me was not my fault. The shame that I felt about being abused and beaten and stuff, that was not my fault. But what I thought it was, it's something so in you that you think you've done something bad to make another person hurt you so much that the thing that you've done must be really, really, really bad.
Okay.
And it takes an awful lot of time. Because to feel that bad, like lower than a piece of lino, yeah, that takes a long, long time. And I go there all the time still when people make me angry. When somebody does something to hurt me intentionally or not, I go back down there and then I say, oh, I have to crawl myself all the way out again, you know.
Or so to be aware that you're gone there and get out. Where are you at with shame now?
Shame?
Yeah.
I'm shameless.
Yeah.
Shameless, I am.
Well done. You've cured yourself.
I've cured myself of my shameless,
of the, the Irish condition. What would you say to someone going through addiction or similar problems now?
The hardest part is just stopping. You know, it's so hard to get to. It's a really, really hard thing to do. I've done. It's just so hard. But you have to find somebody that you can talk to. And for me, it was somebody in the Rutland Centre, you know, that I clicked with. And that was the first time I ever told anybody about loads of stuff, you know what I mean? That went on in my life. And I was 40 at that time, 38. There has to be somebody that you, and that person for me, who she's since passed away, Maura Russell, she knows everything about me. And I do believe that if there's one person in your life that knows everything about you, all the good, all the bad, and doesn't shame you for it and doesn't scold you for it, but they understand that is the way you are because of what has happened to you. And you only get that in a really good, you know.
That's amazing. Yeah. And you just need one.
Just one.
Yeah.
Not everybody gets the chance to get the one, though.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, absolutely. And then, so then the shame lifts, does it? If you can.
You go back and forth with me a lot. Yeah. Like, you know, okay. Is one of my kids doing that now because of something I've done, you know. So I'm 40 years now around, you know. 30 odd years sober and still learning, still going back to therapy.
You say the biggest lesson you've learned is to ask for help.
Yeah. It's also the hardest thing to do because you know you might get it and you might want it in particular. But ask for help, yeah. And I knew I needed help again. About 20 years ago when all that stuff was going on with my marriage breaking up. And the one man that I had always kind of wanted, I had gone to see him in St. Patrick's. He was giving a talk, was Ivor Brown. And I said, this fella knows now what's really, really wrong with me. And he'd be able to drag it out of me, you know.
Yeah.
So I started going to see Ivor and doing regression.
Well, yeah, you were in that terrific film that Alan Gilson.
Oh, yeah, but I was going down to see him for about a year and a half, like, you know. And he would put me, oh my God, so much stuff, so much great stuff. And he would always do a thing that you were ashamed of or something bad that had happened with something nice the following week that we were going to do some really nice memories. And you go back into the memory, you go back into the car with your man, your dad, and you're going up to Donegal and your mother singing and everything. And you feel that love that there was there all of the time, even though there was other stuff.
Okay.
And it was really important for me to go through all of that stuff. He realised that to reclaim the love and the care that was there, you know. And I
to remember not just what you lost, but what I had as well. Back to where we started.
And then that started. And remember my mother drawing pictures. She taught me how to sew. She taught us all how to sew and knit. And, you know, it wasn't all horrible, but you tend to remember the horrific stuff. So he made me remember the good stuff.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah,
and treasure it.
You say you're very optimistic now. Can you become optimistic? Yeah.
It's hard to be optimistic now. I mean, it is in my life and in my family and in my career, I'm optimistic. I'm working on some projects that I hope will get, you know, done. For humanity, it's hard to be optimistic, but I do believe things will happen the way that they're meant to play out, you know, and they're playing out now in front of us. It's very hard to be, it's very hard to look at them. It's very hard to see what's going on, but there is, it's part of a war game, you know, and it's evil and stuff. But I...
And in your own life, you're optimistic?
I'm optimistic. I'm going off to meet, did you ever hear of a fellow called Mike Stoller?
I did, of course, Lieber and Stoller.
So
just for people, they would have written a lot of Elvis's songs.
Oh, Hound Dog, and Hamburg Hotel. So.
And then countless other stuff, don't
you? Yeah, I got an album that they did for Peggy Lee 20 years ago. A man in New Zealand gave it to me. And I spent some time working on it in COVID, trying to find out what it was about. So Mike Stoller phoned me there for my birthday on 90. He says, come on over. He says, we'll do this. He said, you've been banging on about this project now for a long time. He said, it's about time we got it finished. I have started to
work. How old is he now?
92.
Yeah.
He said, will you get into the country? I said, well, he said, let's go to Mexico. So that's kind of funny. But I've been talking to his son, Peter Stoller. And I have recorded, the songs were all about the rise of fascism in America in 1939, about people being murdered because they were gay, about people being incarcerated in mental hospitals because they were a little bit, you know, weird. And the album was deleted after 1,000 copies were sold and the record company just dumped it. So I've been working on it since COVID. And we've done some work with Katrina McLaughlin and the Abbey on it. And I'm not sure if that's the way it has to go. So I'm going to see Mike. If I get in, we might have to meet in Tijuana.
Okay. How bad, says you?
I don't know.
You need to mind yourself, don't you? I'd say there's plenty of temptations in Tijuana, in old Tijuana.
I'll be able to get in to see him. We did a thing during COVID as well. We got some money from the Mermaid in Wicklow and we did some... animations of some of the songs, and a young guy called Josh O'Queeve, who he was only, I think he was 23, but he was completely captivated by this song called Is That All There Is?
Mm-hmm.
Peggy Lee sang it. The album never came out, but she sang that song a lot, and it was written by Thomas Mann. It's about, like, it's awful. It's really about grimness.
Yeah.
And he did the thing, so it's opening in LA, little film documentary, me singing his animation. So
excellent.
That's my excuse for going there.
So, finally, maybe a little bit on getting older and lessons and wisdom there.
It's hell.
Yeah.
I was just saying, I have to start walking, man, or doing something. I went away for a retreat in March, and it was going to be the start of my, you know, my new, you know, another phase of becoming healthy. But look, sure, I'm 70 now. I'll be 70 soon. I'm singing. I mean, I did 28 gigs in Australia last year. I've done so many this year. I'm flying, you know, but I still feel a bit creaky.
Yeah.
So yesterday I went home. I sat on the sofa for the day. And then I said, John, can we go to see the other thing with Leslie? What's his name? Driven. What's his name? Liam Neeson.
The Naked Gun. Yeah.
So we laughed for an hour and 20 minutes. Like, I couldn't even eat my sweets. I was laughing so much. And then came home and went to bed. So just days off, like, of doing telly and stuff. I have to do that.
Yeah.
That time.
Yeah. So. Also, like, the key to it all, have a laugh.
Oh, sick laughing we were. I was actually sick laughing.
Really? listen, I mean, I know on one hand, this is a kind of a, it's a kind of a rambling conversation.
Sorry.
It's true. No, but I'm saying truth bombs all the way through. Like, no, I'm loving it. This is my kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm just saying, people are loving it. Brendan, I got stuck in the car syndrome. I can't get out listening to Mary Cochran. First time I saw her perform in Cork a few years ago, Kinsale gig, still the best gig I was ever at. She's every bit as interesting when off the stage. Love her voice and her humour. What a beautiful soul. That's from Jill. Mary is lovely. It's kind of her to share her experience so honestly. Delighted to hear her happy tones now. Great voice. See, that's like someone saying, well, she's happy now. I'd say you're balking against that. I'm not that happy. Mary, you're amazing and there's no shame. The shame is not getting unconditional love. I hope you can now hold that little girl, Mary, give her a big hug and tell her you love her. Someone else says you're a trooper. Your voice, song is still amazing and moving. Brendan, what a lovely interview. Mary tells it as it was and as it is. I love her honesty and no-nonsense attitude. Powerful, truthful interview with an amazing woman. Honest and fabulous, says someone else. A lot of people getting on, they say, yeah, come on, take it. The one recommending you go for president hasn't come in yet.
Catherine Connolly is going for president.
I saw Mary perform at Forest Fest last weekend. She was super. Only Mary would have a whole tent of people chanting F Trump. What an honest interview. People have been fans for a year. I could go on and on. People have memories like of nights they saw you like years ago and stuff like that that stayed with them. Fantastic. Is it a surprise to you that at nearly 70 you sit, you're more engaged with the work than ever, are you?
Oh, more engaged. But now it's not a distraction. Now it's just the work, you know.
That is the thing. That's the purpose.
So we're doing some really nice gigs coming up to Christmas, back to the Olympia, which is my favourite place really in Dublin. And then I'll go back down to Australia and New Zealand. And in the meantime, I'll have met the Stollers and cooked up our little... What?
On the pig's back.
On the pig's back, Brendan.
On the pig's back, baby.
Yeah.
Okay, and by the way,
Hollywood, here I come.
Never too late. I'll play it at the end of a beautiful new single, Lumberjack.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Mary, thank you so much for that. I think so many
people... all right now.
So many people will have found so much of that so useful on so many different levels. I found it so myself. I'm going out to...
all over the place.
I might not sit out tonight now, but I'm gonna sit out. I think we should all sit out.
Good thing to sit out and just be on your own for a whole night.
I can imagine.
What?
I can imagine, you'd be afraid of what had happened.
I'm training the grandchildren to do it now.
Yeah, okay. Mary Coughlin, thank you so much.
Brendan O'Connor, thank
she's
you.
Up and she's off, she's gone. Off to meet Mike Stoller.
To go to
All right, good luck. She is gone. We'll take a break.